When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, a podcast that's all about comic book movies. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me as always to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are
Seb Patrick
and James Hunt.
We'll be discussing the latest comic book movie and TV news, and then we'll explore one movie or television show in depth during our main discussion. This week we'll be casting our eyes over Jon Favreau's 2008 film Iron Man. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seb and James to explain to me a comics concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. And this week, guys, I'm going to ask you about a whole bunch of heroes. So Batman, Superman, Iron Man, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man, Iceman. How come some of them are spaces in their names, some of them are just one word, and some of them have a hyphen? It makes no sense to me, and it really bothers me. Why? Why?
I think it's mostly just how the logo would have looked.
Stan Lee has claimed that Spider-Man has got a hyphen in his name to differentiate him from Superman on the newsstands so that it would stand out as separate. I don't really believe that that's the case, partly because Spider-Man didn't originally debut in a comic called Spider-Man, and secondly because there is kind of uncovered artwork that shows it the logo being originally drawn without a hyphen. So I think it's Stan Lee doing his usual thing of inventing a fun story after the fact.
There's also an issue of Spider-Man where Stan Lee wrote Superman.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, he accidentally wrote the name Superman?
Yeah.
There is like issue 3 or something, there's just a speech bubble that says Superman in it instead of Spider-Man.
But then Ant-Man has a hyphen as well, right?
Ant-Man has a hyphen because he desperately wants to be Spider-Man. Spider-Man has a hyphen because he's different and important, and so it differentiates him from everyone else.
Well, so I was wondering whether this was a DC Marvel thing. DC have Batman, Superman, Aquaman, but then they have Wonder, Space, Woman. What's that about?
The thing is, you're assuming that all of these characters were created at a time when everything was incredibly carefully thought out and had months of planning, rather than in most instances. Like, 90% of comic book characters were created by writers and artists going, right, what's out there already? How can we file the serial numbers off and do something that sells as well as it? as someone who has been writing articles about the creation of Marvel characters for the last year or so, that's pretty much my main takeaway from it, is it's just, what's there already, let's change the name and paint it a different colour.
Okay, well, let's move on to this week's comic book movie news segment then. And in the first piece of news, regular listeners will have already heard us discussing Spider-Man at great length, Spider-Man joining the MCU. I thought we'd lead off the news this week with one of the things that has affected, and that's some of the other date changes within the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, a lot of the Phase 3 of Marvel has been moved back, but I thought the two most interesting ones that were that Black Panther was due to be released before Infinity War Part 1. That will now be released after Infinity War Part 1. And Inhumans was one of the films that was going to arrive in between the two parts of Infinity War, but now Inhumans will come after Infinity War Part 2. What do you think that means for those two movies, guys?
See, I had this kind of theory that Inhumans and Captain Marvel were going to be middle chapters of Infinity War. Mm. And it, you know, this reshuffling means it looks like that's not going to happen now. Because, I mean, I'm assuming Infinity War has some, like, cosmic element. And both Captain Marvel and Inhumans are cosmic properties in that they exist outside of Marvel Earth, or, you know, can go beyond the confines of Marvel Earth, I should say. So, yeah, so I sort of thought, you know, maybe Avengers Infinity War will end with a certain status quo of Thanos has taken over the Earth or something.
Yeah.
And those two films will exist within that framework, and then Avengers Infinity War Part 2 will, you know, demolish it.
I thought it would make sense, those two movies. I mean, you know very little about Inhumans, right? But it's all linked to the Kree, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that to me seemed like a good way to kind of bring all of the elements of the MCU together for that final, a way of getting the Guardians there even.
Yeah, I mean, it just is, I guess maybe they're going to be more standalone than we think. You know, they broadly haven't done that to introduce characters, so maybe that's why.
Yeah, maybe Inhumans could be the Guardians of the Galaxy of Phase 3, in that it's part of the MCU and there are some crossovers, but actually in terms of the wider story, it's not having much immediate impact. With Black Panther moving to one of those spots in between the two Infinity Wars, those rumours that were circulating when Latino Review happened to be very, very right about Spider-Man kind of suggested that the direction that Marvel was planning to take was that the first part of Infinity War really wouldn't feature many of the traditional heroes that we know well. And that we would probably be seeing characters like Black Panther there and Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver.
All your favourites.
Hawkeye and Black Widow, rather than Hulk, Thor, Iron Man, Captain America.
And then in the second half, it could turn out that Black Panther was actually Steve Rogers wearing a Black Panther costume. That would be a brilliant idea, and I can't believe no one's
deep,
ever thought
Seven,
of it done it in a comic before.
What, the minstrel cinematic universe?
You may not know that, or you presumably don't know this. That genuinely was what happened in Ultimates Volume 3.
Wait, Steve Rogers blacks up in Ultimates?
He doesn't black up, but he wears a Black Panther costume, pretending to be this mysterious new member of the Ultimates.
Right.
I mean, I'm saying it, and I find it difficult to believe that it actually happened, but it's not even in the top five things that I find it difficult to believe happened in Jeff Loeb's Ultimates comics.
But yeah, my general point is, I was quite surprised that Black Panther would be moving after Infinity War, because I just assumed he was going to be a big part of Infinity
War. You would think. Unless...
Which he still might be, but it would be strange. You have to wonder what this has made Marvel have to very quickly change in their plans.
I mean, like you say, I mean, the idea of it, of Infinity War Part 1 being the characters we don't know so well, I mean, a part of that could be we haven't met them in their own films, and then we go and explore them a bit after that. Although that's a very risky strategy, because you know, the whole point of an Avengers film is here's all these characters you know and love from these previous films together. So to do an Avengers film where you're introducing them all in one film could be more problematic.
I do kind of like the idea of Phase 3 slowly taking the established Avengers and kind of removing them from the equation. As I think I've said before, I wouldn't be surprised if Hulk is in outer space by the end of Age of Ultron.
To be honest, it's sort of necessary to do that as well. I mean, in the comics, the Avengers has a constantly rotating lineup, and if you want to get away from the idea of Avengers has to be these characters, like, they've got to do it sooner rather than later, if only because their big guns are going to have to be recast at some point.
Let's move on to our second piece of news. It's been out there for quite a while now, but it's been our first chance to properly talk about it. Netflix's Daredevil trailer went online, and we're only a couple of episodes removed from reviewing the 2003 Daredevil. I don't know about you guys, but for me, all Daredevil stuff seems really fresh in my brain at the moment. And that trailer looked exciting, not the least to me, because looks like a lot of Man Without Fear, which
you read.
I went and read, didn't I?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, we've talked about the costume, and, you know, I know that it's been said that the costume will hopefully not be the black costume throughout.
It will evolve, Seb.
And so I don't really want to comment on how Charlie Cox looks as Daredevil, because it's kind of nondescript anyway, but as Matt Murdock, from what we've seen of him in that trailer, which admittedly isn't very much, I can buy him as the character. I've always kind of thought of him as a bit weedy, but...
You see those abs, Seb?
Yeah.
Oh, they were good.
What I found odd about the trailer was that so much of the 2003 Daredevil was in there. Like, it was very surprisingly influenced by it. Like, almost as if they've gone, well, this is the version people are most familiar with, so let's stick to that.
What do you mean by that? Which bits?
Specifically, it's things like it being really sort of violent and bloody, and Daredevil being covered in scars.
And the priest.
Like, that, none of that is...
For me, that I thought that looked like more Netflix laying down a marker and saying, this is what our shows are going to be like. To me, being so fresh off of The Man Without Fear, it seemed heavily influenced by that, and that the big changes were that there is no Elektra, but that we've got Karen Page, and Karen Page looked like the Karen Page that I'd read in the Guardian Devil comics.
Yeah, Karen Page looks like she's going to be a drug addict in this, which isn't how she was introduced at all, but I can see why they would start at that point, given that that's the kind of famous incarnation of the character.
And I like the actress. I like the guy that they've got to play Foggy. My general takeaway was I like the look of that Daredevil trailer. I'm still totally on board with Charlie Cox. And everything that the showrunner said about the show kind of made me quietly encouraged.
I quite like that it's, you know, the whole trailer has got this feel of, it's a gritty AMC series about a guy going and beating people up, and everything's got that kind of blue light, and it's all that, which if done wrongly can be a sort of, oh, this isn't like a comic book. And then right at the very end you have the actual proper Daredevil logo from the comics rather than some, you know, metallic thing that's, you know. Yeah, I like that it's not afraid of the fact that it's based on a comic, which, you know, Marvel Studios never have been, but it's still something like Daredevil would be very easy to completely divorce from its comic bookness, and they don't seem to be doing that.
The thing that makes me quite optimistic about it is that it's being run by Stephen DeKnight, who worked on Angel and was the showrunner for Spartacus. And again, we talked about Drew Goddard's connection to Joss Whedon in the Spider-Man podcast.
Yeah.
Stephen DeKnight's like in that world as well. Like he came up with Joss Whedon. So, you know, I have trust in that set of people.
And I think Drew Goddard was attached for long enough that I would be shocked if his influence has been totally scrubbed out. But yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic. And I've got to be honest, watching a trailer for a comic book property that I feel I actually know some of the background about is very exciting. Probably the first time that has ever happened. Well, since Watchmen, I guess. So yeah, I'm on board. Okay, let's move on to our final piece of news now. And there was an article on Bleeding Cool breaking down the pilot script for AMC's Preacher. Seb, I know nothing about Preacher, so tell me all about it.
So Preacher is a Vertigo series from the mid to late 90s, ran for 60-odd issues, collected in 10 books. Behind Sandman, it's probably the most significant Vertigo book. Although, unlike Sandman, it doesn't have any kind of connection to the DC universe or anything. It's just completely standalone. Written by Garth Ennis, drawn by Steve Dillon. It's the story of a preacher from Texas who gets imbued with a supernatural power that may or may not be more powerful than God itself.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, it's a very black comedy, incredibly violent road movie type thing. He basically goes off with his ex-girlfriend, who's now hitman. That's not the right word, you know what I mean?
Assassin.
Yeah, assassin. But assassin.
A female really hitman.
Yeah, a hit woman.
Hit-woman.
Yeah, not hit girl though. And a hard-drinking Irish vampire called Cassidy. They go off in search of God because they discover that God has abandoned heaven and let everything go into disarray. It's absolutely brilliant. It's not without certain problematic elements from time to time, but it is just it's a landmark achievement in comics. It's been talked about as a potential film or TV series for absolutely years, and now AMC are finally doing it. It's the kind of thing that I would be incredibly skeptical of live action's ability to in any way get right, and I was even more skeptical when it was announced that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg were going to be doing it. Not that they're bad writers, but that
They don't have precedent in this area, really.
Exactly. Yeah. But Rich Johnson posted a review of the pilot script with also some script excerpts on Bleeding Cool, but the excerpts have now been taken down, but the article is still there. But he says that the pilot is quite different from the early issues of Preacher, but that it very much maintains the tone and the spirit. So a lot of the kind of character, like people encounter each other at different times rather than it just being a straight up adaptation of the plot in order to simplify things and maybe bring a few things forward. And that, you know, none of the dialogue in the script excerpts that he posted is actual dialogue from the comics. So that seems to, I mean, I don't watch or read Walking Dead, but that sounds to me quite similar to what Walking Dead has done in terms of, yeah, you know, having the spirit of the comic, but very much being its own thing and going its own way.
Hey, Seb, listen to this, right? I've read like the first 20 issues, first three or four volumes of The Walking Dead and watch the TV show.
So that is an area you definitely have the advantage on me then.
I have no memory of what happens on the page then.
Yeah. But yeah, it sounds, I'm more optimistic on it about it based on this than I would have been before. It's also quite interesting that the script explicitly states that Tulip, Jesse's on and off girlfriend, is black in the TV version, which she isn't. She's white and blonde in the comic, which makes sense because it's a comic that could do to have, you know, its diversity level increase. It also potentially brings an interesting element because a lot of the comic is set in the Deep South, and actually there's a storyline later on in the series involving racism and the KKK, and I wonder if they're going to bring that element into it, but involve Tulip rather than the characters that are involved in it later in the series. So, yeah, it's...
positive news for Preacher.
I think so.
And just to wrap up the last couple of pieces of news from this week, Warner Brothers have finally found their Rick Flag. Joel Kinnaman is the man who will now be replacing Tom Hardy. So maybe not the A-list name that DC Warner Brothers were hoping for, but Joel Kinnaman's an actor I like, so hopefully that will be good news for that movie. And then Gina Carano is joining the cast of Deadpool. She'll be starring opposite Ryan Reynolds and will be playing a mutant character known as Angel Dust. And if Gina Carano should be doing anything, it's superhero movies, so I think that sounds good as well. Does that seem like a good time to move on to our main section, which is Iron Man? I think it does. So let's move on now then to our spoiler-filled discussion of Iron Man. But before we start that discussion, let's listen to the original trailer for the movie.
No one's allowed to talk, is that it? You can't talk?
No, you intimidate them.
Good God, you're a woman.
Is it better to be feared or respected? And I say, is it too much to ask for both? I humbly present the Jericho. To peace.
Tony Stark. Now you work for me.
What are you building, Stark?
Your eyes are red. Your tears for your long-lost boss?
Tears of joy. I hate job hunting.
Yeah, vacation's over.
Welcome home, sir.
Put up the scanner, will you?
What happened over there?
I have my eyes open.
I want to protect the people I put in harm's way.
A man with a dozen of these can rule all of Asia.
Yeah, I can fly.
Right, okay, so that was the Iron Man trailer. I thought, given that this is definitely the movie that kicks off the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I just wanted to go back to 2005, pre these movies being made, when Marvel kind of put into place the plans to make this cinematic universe of films, and just how big of a risk it was. Like, people called Guardians of the Galaxy a risk last year, in that they were much lesser known characters, but they were going into the MCU. In 2005, Marvel Studios made a deal with the Wall Street firm Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch gave them $525 million in non-recourse debt facility, which was going to be used by Marvel to finance up to 10 films based on characters that it still retained the rights to. And the interesting thing is that they gave up those characters as collateral to Merrill Lynch, i.e. if this all went horribly wrong and Marvel got close to bankruptcy again, those kind of only characters that they had left were who they were going to be giving up in return. And so the 10 characters at that time were Captain America, the Avengers, the concept of the Avengers, Nick Fury, Black Panther, Ant-Man, Cloak and Dagger, Doctor Strange, Hawkeye, Power Pack, and Shang-Chi.
How are they going to do the Marvel Universe without Power Pack and Cloak and Dagger?
I mean, I was reading that list and going, what? I'd still not heard of those characters. I've got no idea who some of those are whatsoever. The rights to Thor reverted back to Marvel in the years between that happening and the MCU kicking off. But what a ballsy move to say, hey, we can make our own movies, we can do it ourselves, we don't have to sell off the rights anymore. This is at the time that Marvel was still partnering with Paramount rather than Disney. And that, hey, yeah, we're gonna go off and make our own films with those characters.
And the interesting thing about that deal is that there was a realistic prospect that Marvel could have lost the rights to those characters and you could have had DC publishing Captain America. Like, I mean, realistically, what would have happened is the bank would have owned Captain America and licensed it to Marvel to publish the comics.
Yes.
But potentially, you know, DC Warner could have come and bought those characters.
Well, Wall Street would have been running comic books and comic book movies.
Well, quite.
And then I'm going to read to you from another article here, which is from the New York Times, written by Sharon Waxman in June 2007. Sharon Waxman, who now runs the Hollywood Trade, The Rat, talking about this deal and what it meant. In this article, there are people from the financial world saying, we know that most movies do not actually make money, or a lot of movies, so I don't know why they come out at the end of the day, even when you adjust for risk and the time it takes. Why go through all of this except to generate fees for Merrill Lynch and some lawyers? The article then goes on to say, additionally, Marvel's slate of films will be based on second-tier superheroes who may not resonate with younger moviegoers. And the Iron Man, for example, for Iron Man, Marvel chose to cast Mr. Downey, 42, to play the millionaire industrialist Tony Stark, an actor well beyond the demographic of the movie's natural fan base of adolescent boys.
I mean, it's easy to laugh in hindsight, but...
It is easy to laugh, but again, a year before Iron Man came out and was a huge hit critically and commercially, people were still going, why are they doing this? And why are they making these creative decisions? That seems crazy.
The thing is, like, even at the time, like, specifically in the comics, Iron Man was sort of... The reason he wasn't already in another film was because Iron Man wasn't very good and, you know, who would want to do it?
Well, I think they had been trying to get Iron Man films off the ground for the best part of a decade, but the fact was that they just couldn't realise them.
Yeah. I mean, they tried to get New Line to do it, didn't they, with Tom Cruise?
I think it had passed around quite a few times between different studios.
Yeah, but the fact that it never got made was because Spider-Man and the X-Men were the big properties, and why would you want to do a Captain America, Iron Man, Thor film?
Yeah, and so we have discussions on email before we make each of these podcasts, and you two guys are going that you were going to find it difficult to recommend me great Iron Man stories because he was such of a B-lister beforehand. So what were Marvel thinking kicking off with Iron Man? Was it literally that he was the best they had to play with?
Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, he did at least have a bit of name recognition. There had been a cartoon with him in the 90s. It wasn't X-Men or Spider-Man levels of popularity as far as the cartoons go, but people would have heard of him. It was at least a brand that you could launch that you couldn't with, well, Shang-Chi, for example.
It was part of the Marvel Action Hour as a double bill with Fantastic Four.
Yeah, I mean, I would say of the characters that they still had the rights to, Captain America and Iron Man would be the two that some member of the general public might have had the best chance of having heard of. And you don't want to lead with Captain America. I mean, now we know how good Marvel Studios are at doing Captain America, but they made absolutely the right choice for that not to be the first one. To establish that they could make good films, to get the trust to then go, okay, we're doing Captain America, which we know you all think is a bit rubbish, but... bear with us. At least Iron Man has got a hook.
I don't know whether I've mentioned this before, but in 2008, there was another superhero movie, Hancock, with Will Smith playing a drunken parody of a superhero, in which he picks up a comic book that is quite obviously Thor and openly makes fun of how ridiculous it is. That's another character that at that time, and I remember watching that film and going, God, yeah, I wonder what a Thor movie would look like. That would be bizarre.
Thor had much more in the way of good comics before his movie than Iron Man. Still not some of the greatest, but there's good 1980s Thor comics in a way that there aren't good Iron Man comics.
But from those list of characters I just read, was Iron Man the best choice?
Iron Man at least has a very cinematic appeal. Like, you can imagine Iron Man as a sort of effects-driven blockbuster. When you look at things like Thor, like, you're probably looking at Thor going, well, that's a lot of money on something that could end up looking like a bad Lord of the Rings imitation.
Mm. I think also, bearing in mind that this is a post Christopher Nolan Batman landscape, Iron Man you can do with some semblance of realism just because it's all based on technology. So it's bloke develops amazing technology and flies around in a suit, not bloke gets bitten by a radioactive iron and has iron powers.
I was thinking that watching it, it struck me that it was probably the first, and maybe still the only like tech superhero. Like, I know Batman has his, you know, various gadgets, but mostly it's that he's a pathological fucking suit. this is really driven by technology and the fact that the film spends so much time actually watching Tony Stark put together his various iterations of the Iron Man suit.
That's what I mean about, you know, it's got a good hook. So the fact that they have that, it hasn't necessarily been done that well in the comics, it's cinematic, like you say.
Yeah.
The thing I would say about Iron Man is that once you get rid of Captain America from that list for, you know, reasons of jingoism or whatever, you can see he's basically the only straight sort of superhero in terms of the classic interpretation of, you know, a guy with a secret identity and a, you know, special ability. He's a millionaire who represents sort of peak human intelligence. You can see the links to characters like Superman and Batman in a way that you can't with, say, Shang-Chi or Cloak and Dagger.
I guess the only other one that you would have gone, well, at least Hulk had a lot of pop cultural cachet, and that there had been a movie out, albeit, I mean, actually, that first Hulk movie was relatively successful. It just wasn't, I don't think it was ever designed to be a long-term comic book thing.
That's the thing. I think if that Hulk film hadn't existed, I think they would have led with Hulk.
And then another thing that I think was key, and Seb, you mentioned that this came post Batman Begins. Superhero movies were darker, and then Iron Man shows up, and you've got, from the very first scene, AC/DC playing in the background, Robert Downey Jr. turning up with this obscene facial hair, and quipping and making jokes about the army guys throwing up gang symbols, and he's from the word go. Is charismatic and funny and likable, and this is something that Marvel has now made its stock and trade, but this is a funny movie.
Although it does, after that initial moment, it does go pretty dark for a while. You know, there's some pretty brutal stuff, like when the guy's about to get tortured, or, you know, when everyone's getting shot and stuff. It doesn't hold back on being quite unpleasant and violent in those first 20 minutes or so. The way that they structure it is odd, but it works, because he's so unpleasant in, you know, when we flash back and spend those, you know, 20 minutes or so establishing what he was like beforehand. If that was the cold open to the film, you would get to the point where he gets kidnapped and you would think, why am I supposed to give a shit about this? But the fact that the first thing you see is, firstly, him being, okay, while a bit cocky, at least being charismatic, then you see him getting kidnapped, so there's your, we're supposed to sympathise with him, then you go back and it's, well, actually, he was a complete dick before all of this. You've already got set up in your mind, oh, so there's going to be some kind of redemption. Whereas if they spent that 20 minutes just with him being Tony Stark, the weapons dealer, like, you would have a real, even with all the natural charisma of Robert Downey Jr., which is a hell of a lot, I think it would be that much more difficult to pull it around to liking him by the time he escapes, you know?
Yeah, it bears mentioning, an incredibly charismatic dick. The kind of A-list movie actor kind of dick who you can completely imagine is a total tool to everyone around him, but all the models want to sleep with him. You get that about that character. He's really well realised and fantastically cast.
If you were to explain to someone who wasn't, like, around and paying attention to films when Iron Man first came out, that casting Robert Downey Jr. was ever seen as a risk, they would just look at you like you were mad. You know, it's so easy to forget the status that he was in at that point. You know, the fact that he had been seen as this brilliant actor in the 90s, that he had completely gone off the rails, and that the very idea of having him lead a huge budget blockbuster, everyone thought that was going to blow up in their face. And then the moment he walks onto the screen, you cannot imagine anyone in the world being more perfect for that role.
It would be sort of akin to them saying, like, oh, Charlie Sheen is going to be our new Captain America.
Yeah, well, not a million miles away. I seem to remember at the time as well that everyone was kind of like, whoa, Robert Downey Jr. And even internally at Marvel Studios, and I think they had to kind of put out the confident statements, but I remember hearing that Jon Favreau essentially had to say, look, Marvel, I want this guy. I really want this guy. He's willing to work for essentially nothing, and you'll thank me later. And I think that's why that Robert Downey Jr. was so hardline with his negotiations for extending his contracts later down the line, is because, to begin with, they were paying him peanuts.
I remember when I went to the press conference for the first Iron Man, Robert Downey Jr. was saying that Terrence Howard was getting paid more than him for the film, and Terrence Howard tried to sort of laugh it off.
But it was true, yeah. One of the reasons that Terrence Howard didn't return. They needed to free up some of that budget space for Robert Downey Jr. That Robert Downey Jr. casting, again, go back to something that I read out from the article at the start. He was 42. Gwyneth Paltrow was in her mid-30s.
Which in Hollywood woman years is, you know.
And then we've got a villain who is in his 60s.
It's not a film that seems in any way to have been made with, what demographics are we appealing to? Maybe just because everything was such a risk and they were staking so much, but it was just, let's just do this. You know, we're just going to make this film and make this entertaining film with the right people.
Maybe it was, hey, if we fuck up, we've got the Incredible Hulk coming yeah. next, which we've got more confidence.
I remember when Robert Downey Jr. was announced, I just remember having conversations with my friends saying, like, well, immediately you can tell that he's the perfect choice for Tony Stark, because Tony Stark has this kind of movie star appeal, but with an undercurrent of will he go off the rails and everything go wrong. And you can imagine the only place I was really familiar with Robert Downey Jr. was from Ally McBeal, which was him in sort of his recovery period. But I mean, I can see why Jon Favreau would have been able to convince people that he is Tony Stark, because there are parallels there that he's clearly brought to the role.
I don't think Jon Favreau gets the credit he deserves for what he made possible in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Mm.
The more you think about it, it's like, yeah, Jon Favreau is responsible for everything that followed.
Iron Man does really set the tone, doesn't it? Like, yeah. Incredible Hulk doesn't really follow it because, you know, they were being made.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The same time, but every successful film they've had since has sort of been, let's just do Iron Man again.
And it's because I think the real watchword with Iron Man, and the thing that really distinguishes it, is character. Like, it has a great hook and everything, but really the one word that I would take away that describes Iron Man more than anything else is character. But as in both, it has interesting characters and the film itself has character and personality, and that has been the most important thing in every other Marvel film that's followed, has always been character.
I've got written down in my notes here, there's something that I wrote like 5-10 minutes into the movie. This film absolutely reflects the confidence of its protagonist. You almost feel like this is a movie that is being made by Tony Stark.
Yeah, actually.
From the word go, the confidence it has in terms of that structure, the pacing is sublime. And I've got a few problems with the third act of the movie that we'll get to in a little bit. But that first hour and the way that... And I've given origin stories a lot of stick in the last couple of weeks, but the way that first hour constructs that origin story, and essentially this movie is 90% origin story, and I'm totally fine with that for Iron Man. It makes complete sense. This should be an origin story. It's actually when it starts to try and build the villain of the piece around it that I think it falls down a little bit.
I think it's the best origin in a superhero movie since the original Superman, in terms of how the origin is told and how it's put together and how it's done. I really think it's that good.
It treats it as his origin as a proper story, not let's have this inciting event at the start and then watch what he does with this new powers. The whole film is him getting to the stage where his Iron Man suit is competent enough, you know, getting to the stage that he can probably go and implement it, which is that bit in the desert. And then from a character point of view, getting Tony Stark to the point, which we see him at the end of the movie, where he says, I am Iron Man. And that is the movie. And the fact that it has a fight with Jeff Bridges in a fat iron suit happens to be incidental.
Well, this is the sort of Marvel philosophy, isn't it? Which is that for Marvel, you sort of care more about the people than the superheroes. Like, that's one of the sort of distinguishing things between Marvel and DC, is that when you're watching a Batman film, you're more interested in Batman than Bruce Wayne.
And I think another Marvel Studios thing has been, it's about the hero rather than the villain, and that's quite clearly the case here. It is all about Tony Stark.
Yeah, although I think Stane is probably one of the better villains, all things considered.
Yeah, I like him. I think he's good as a sort of... The only thing that doesn't work, aside from the big metal fat suit, although I like the fight scene, actually, I think it's well done. The only thing that doesn't really work is you cannot in any way buy that nobody thinks that Stane is a bad guy. I mean, he looks and sounds like a bad guy.
I think that's the casting. Well, because he worked for his father, and his father had a relationship with him, and he's clearly someone that has been involved with their family for years. Incidentally, when we're meeting maybe Howard Stark again and Alexander Pierce, let's bring Jeff Bridges back in his Tron Legacy de-aged face. Yeah? Yeah? I don't know if you saw the interviews that Jeff Bridges gave in the last week or so, where he was talking about, he's promoting Seventh Son, and they asked him about Iron Man, and he said, actually, there was supposed to be a scene at the end of the movie where you saw Stane in the suit and he was still alive, and that, yes, he was outed as being a villain, but that he was alive and with the potential to come back later. And then they came back to him a couple of, before the film was finished, and goes, no, actually, we've just killed you.
Well, on the deleted scenes, the ending was reshot, wasn't it, slightly, to make it clear that he was killed?
Yeah, which is a shame. I genuinely think that's a shame. I don't think the arc of the Tony Stark facing off against a villain in this film works entirely, because it's so much about the origin story. And I genuinely think when they have that 15-minute fight scene at the end of the film, the movie grinds to a halt. I think it's a general Marvel Studios problem that they tend to go, how do we end this movie? Let's just have those people scrap. And that can be a scene that we throw a lot of dollars at, and hopefully it'll be fine. I just don't think it pays off. I like the moment when Stane comes and steals the arc reactor from his chest, but like, from that moment until the press conference at the end, I kind of switch off every time.
I think it sort of redeems it that it's not too long.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing worse than a superhero fight that goes on for 45 minutes at the end of a film.
Yeah, you're like, destroy Metropolis already. But yeah, I think the casting of Jeff Bridges is pretty smart. Because it's Jeff Bridges, we're predisposed to like him. And yes, he has the bald head and the beard, and he looks fairly villainous. He's such an avuncular actor.
Yeah, I like how much fun he's having with it. He's chewing up the screen and he knows it, but it doesn't ever quite tip into actually winking at the audience. Yeah, he's enjoying that role, and it does make him quite a joy to watch.
I love that take where he's shouting at Tony and he like swings his arm and it flips his tie over his shoulder, and they clearly were like, oh, let's leave that in because it's funny. Like, he's so angry he's messing up his own suit. Like, it couldn't have been done on purpose, but they must have just thought, that is funny, we'll leave it in.
Can I ask you about the Leslie Bibb character, who is the Vanity Fair journalist?
Christine Everhart.
She got comic book precedence.
Well, again, like, in the comics, Christine Everhart is a Bugle reporter, I think.
Okay.
And they just sort of slap the name on the character as a sort of nod.
Because Vanity Fair seems to get some real great access in this movie, don't they?
Yeah, why are they covering a press conference at a weapons manufacturer?
Yes.
Because he's Tony Stark, he's a playboy.
But she's on the front row, and she's got enough power that she can butt in when he's doing his press conference.
Yeah.
What? Are you saying someone with the surname Stark got close to an attractive woman?
Also, oh God, this was one of the early lines, and I'd forgotten about it. Oh, he's like, I got caught doing a piece for Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
Which is horrible, but it's such, I mean, again, and that's pre his capture.
Yeah, it's in the Tony Stark is a dick phase. Yeah. Like, the next thing we see after that is his plane, where his air hostesses turn into lap dancers.
Yes.
You know, it's like, it's tacky, but it's supposed to be, you know.
And it kind of is funny coming from that character. You kind of got, it's one of those, you've got to check yourself. Did he just say that? He did just say that.
Is Tony Stark's wit being used for evil?
And it's kind of rare in a superhero origin movie. Like, because the thing is that this film is two origins, really. It's the origin of the Iron Man technology and the character of Iron Man, but it's also the origin of Tony Stark as a hero. Because usually in a superhero movie, when you meet the character before they've become a superhero, they're a good person. They're the kind of person who would be a hero. But and really, if you were to boil down the arc of the film Iron Man, I think you can boil it down in one sentence as Tony Stark realizes it would be really cool if he was a superhero.
Yes.
Like, there is that line right at the end of the press conference where he's saying, you know, what if I was a superhero? It'd be awesome. Yeah. And that's like the light bulb in his head. And that's when he's, yeah, I'm going to be a superhero because it would be great to be a superhero.
I also thought it was quite a smart moment in that if you don't wait until the end of the credits and Nick Fury turns up, there's something in that line reading, the way that line is put together, that you immediately buy that there are other superheroes in that world, that superhero is a thing that in that world you can be.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like he can say the word superhero and it means something.
Let's talk about some of the characters we haven't got to yet, or we haven't really got to properly. So we've got Gwyneth Paltrow as Pepper Potts and we've got Terrence Howard as Rhodey. What do we think of those two in the movie?
I'm a pretty big fan of Pepper in these films.
Yeah, I
think she's at her best in the third one. I think her problem is, a lot of the problems with the third act of this film also kind of center around her a little bit. She gets a little bit screaming damsel in distress in the third act, but I absolutely love the dynamic between her and Tony.
She is proactive though. That is something to her credit.
Yeah, she is proactive in that, and she contributes to the plot getting sorted out. But there are, when we were watching it last night, there were a couple of moments where my wife was just like, run away quicker, you idiot, because she's just kind of standing there screaming.
Also, our first introduction to ineffective S.H.I.E.L.D. agents. Coulson with his five S.H.I.E.L.D. agents go help Pepper, and then Ironmonger in his big suit just quickly disposes of those guys.
Yeah. But no, I mean, yeah, I think generally Pepper is great because, as I say, it's the kind of dynamic that you don't see very often in this type of movie, and even notwithstanding the fact that you've got an actor and an actress who are a bit older than usual, their chemistry together is fantastic, and I like that it doesn't just easily go for, you know, obviously eventually they are a couple by the end of Iron Man 2, but that develops and you see why it develops, and you see that as Tony becomes a better person, he begins to appreciate her more, but also she is a massive influence on him becoming a better person. Yeah, I really like that character and that dynamic. I think Pepper's probably my favourite out of the female MCU characters, to be honest.
Peggy Carter, but apart from that, yes. I actually found rewatching this film, because I mean, I'll be honest, the first time I saw Iron Man, I thought that was okay. I didn't see it at the cinemas. I saw it when it came out on DVD, and I was like, that was okay. I like Tony Stark, but the third act is rubbish, and I wasn't sure about this and that and the other, and every time I watch it, it grows on me. That was me just being flat out wrong. And one of the main areas is I was really lukewarm on Pepper. I'm never really a huge Gwyneth Paltrow fan. But watching it this time, the one scene that I thought that Gwyneth Paltrow just gets so right is when Tony gets off the plane after he's come back from his capture. And she's got the puffy eyes, and there's just a look on her face that says so much about what their relationship is.
I thought you were going to say the scene where she has to take the copper wire out. That's my favourite scene in the whole film.
The operation scene, let's call it.
I love that because that scene boils down their relationship. And at this point, that kind of weird sense of intimacy that they have while she works for him and she's, you know, she's his butler slash assistant. It just, and in terms of their chemistry and the way that they spark off each other, that scene is just, yeah, I love it.
And I think one of their next scenes is when she walks in and sees him in the suit and he's like, oh, come on, you've caught me in much worse situations than this. Yeah. That was another one of those lines that reminded me of the Star-Lord Jackson Pollock line in Guardians. And again, just how much this film set up tonally for the MCU.
Terrence Howard then?
Yeah, so Terrence Howard. What do we think of Terrence Howard?
You can sort of tell he was the first person cast, can't you? Because he doesn't have any chemistry with the other other actors.
Yeah.
It's like they had Terrence Howard and then they were like, oh, we've got Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow and they work amazing together. I guess we'll have to put him next to Terrence Howard.
I don't dislike Terrence Howard as an actor. But yeah, he does stick out like a bit of a sore thumb in this. He's not.
It's notable that when you get to Iron Man 2 and he's recast, it's Don Cheadle who works brilliantly with Robert Downey Jr.
You sort of, it's difficult to see in that film. Like, you can see why Tony and Pepper are friends, and you can even see why Tony and Happy are friends. You can't really see why Tony and Rhodey are friends. They just don't seem like personalities that click. And then, yeah, as soon as it's Don Cheadle, you know, they you could never have thrown Terrence Howard's Rhodey into that Lethal Weapon buddy comedy that you get for 20 minutes in Iron Man 3, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that has to be one of the most tragic lines in movie history. Next time, baby.
Oh, no.
It's impossibly awkward to watch now.
It is. It's even more of... I know we keep making reference to it, but it's even more of a Billy Dee Williams moment than Billy Dee Williams.
It's one of the few absolutely knowing moments in the film. Hey, we're a movie and we're going to have a sequel. And look, we're going to tell you right now, that's going to happen in the sequel.
Yeah.
And every comic book fan is going, we're going to see War Machine.
it would annoy me more than it does. But you were talking before about how the film is so confident.
Yes.
and that confidence shines through, and that moment is a look, we know this film is shit hot and there are going to be more. Mm. So we know we're going to get the chance to do War Machine because you're going to love this film as much as we
yeah,
do.
Yeah, it's not like the Ant-Man trailer, is it, where they're going, oh please like it even though we're called Ant-Man. It's like we're saying we're awesome and we're coming back.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you'll probably have to divorce the marketing, because you never know, we might get an Ant-Man movie that is just so ballsy and sure of itself that does the same kind of stuff. But I mean, You get that at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy, don't you? If the Guardians will be back,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's no two ways about it. Even though it's Terrence Howard, and now we watch back and go, yeah. I mean, not for you, Terrence, but for your character, absolutely. But yeah, it's one of those nice moments where you go, this film knows how good it is.
Yeah.
As long as they're not absolutely wrong, as long as they don't throw it those moments and you go, yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
If they're wrong, it's arrogance, and if they're right, it's confidence.
It's, in fact, what it reminds me of is Sinestro at the end of Green Lantern. You get, I would be stunned if we see you back in that suit, Mark Strong. Let's talk about the stuff at the end of the film, the post-credit sequence with Nick Fury, and just generally the involvement of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Coulson throughout the film. James, you said on one of our email threads that's pretty much the most important moment in comic book movie history.
Actually, it was me who said that.
Oh, was it you, Seb? Sorry.
I mean, to be fair, it was probably one of the most important moments in my entire life.
James is married with child, by the way.
Yeah.
That's important for the listeners to know.
I remember sitting there in the cinema and, like, literally banging the armrest in just unrestrained glee at the idea of there being an Avengers. And more pointedly, the idea that they were going to bring the idea of crossovers and multi-superhero interactions to the cinema.
And that they cast Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
But had the confidence to hold him back for post-credits.
Well, the thing is, because Samuel L. Jackson was the model for Nick Fury in Ultimates, the comic, as soon as you put him on screen, you're like, you instantly see where it's going. Like, it wasn't like having some kind of, you know, random old guy turn up as, you know, white Nick Fury from the Marvel universe proper.
Yeah.
It was saying, like, look, we've got all these ideas that we've refined from the Ultimate comics, and we're going to bring them to the screen.
The possibilities are endless. I've got to say, I do appreciate Sam Jackson's approach to the MCU as well, in that, you know, he's willing to show up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. when they want him to show up. And I saw someone recently asked him, you know, you signed that mega contract for Marvel, is that nearly up? And he was like, I think I've got two films left, but I'll extend.
He wants his own film though, doesn't he? He wants the Nick Fury film. I mean, he deserves it at this point.
I'd be well up for a Nick Fury film.
Without David Hasselhoff.
I mean, it's nice when he gets his moments in stuff like The Winter Soldier, you know, in that car chase sequence, to watch him actually in action and doing stuff. It would be nice to have him do a whole movie. But yeah, so that post-credit sequence where Nick Fury turns up, says, I'm Nick Fury, and there is an Avengers initiative, and we need to talk about it. I mean, as comic book fans, when you see Coulson running around and dropping the name S.H.I.E.L.D., do you suspect that that's what's coming at the end of the movie, when you're watching it for the first time?
I mean, I assumed they were doing something with S.H.I.E.L.D. Like, I was just, you know, I was glad that they were incorporating S.H.I.E.L.D. as a comics concept. I had no idea Samuel L. Jackson was going to turn up, Nick Fury was going to turn up, and, you know, recruit him to the Avengers, because, I mean, if nothing else, that's not really how the Avengers traditionally works. Like, again, it's something they imported from the Ultimate setup, but nothing about Iron Man resembles the Ultimate version. It's more, you know, visually speaking, it's more the Marvel Universe version, so you weren't expecting it to go in that direction, but when it did, you're very happy.
What did you think of the post-credit scene, Seb?
Well, as I say, you know, I mean, it is just like it's ridiculously important in terms of what it sets up. And I love the deliberate use of language to actually say you're part of a wider universe, because that puts in everyone's head Marvel Universe. But the other thing that I think is great about it is seeing it for the first time in the cinema and there only being about three other people who'd stayed to the end, because you could tell the three people who were on the internet reading about comic book movies who knew there was going to be one. Whereas now you go and see them and most people stay behind, because it's just become a thing. And it's become a thing in films that aren't comic book films to do these.
Yeah.
And I know Iron Man wasn't the first to do a kind of a mid-credits or a post-credits scene. You know, Daredevil had a mid-credits. X-Men The Last Stand had done one. I'm sure there are others. But there's just something about this idea of tacking on to the end of the film, setting up the next one in some way, or a future one in some way. And it's just become this integral part now of blockbuster films. But back then, no one even knew to wait around. I almost felt like standing up and going, hey, don't you know about the scene at the end? Where are you going?
To be fair, I still feel like that when people walk out at the end of a Marvel film. Like,
yeah.
Are they idiots? Do they just not care? Why are they even here?
Yeah, what do we think of Coulson coming in and out? Because I personally think that Coulson kind of comes into his own in first that short film where he gets to kick a load of ass, and then secondly when he gets Joss Whedon dialogue put in his mouth. But he's a fun addition here. I quite like the idea of him being this just perky little guy in a suit who is just, he just wants to get his paperwork filed almost.
It surprised me how much he was in this watching it again, because I remembered him showing up a couple of times to talk about S.H.I.E.L.D. and I completely forgot that he had any involvement in the actual finale. But yeah, he's good fun.
He's sort of, the character has been kind of diluted in a way over the years, from giving him sort of more to do, bringing him back to life, etc.
Also, a full head of hair in Iron Man.
Well, I do, I like the version of Coulson who is like a sort of mid-level administrator more than the version who is an action star.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, it's just, as a character, he's funnier like that.
Shall we get to your comic book recommendations? We'll bring our Iron Man chat to an end and you can tell me where I should be going to read more Iron Man.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really obvious one, really, and it kind of in some ways has more relevance to Iron Man 3, but it's very relevant because it's probably one of the few comics that was an influence on the movie, which is Extremis by Warren Ellis and Adi Granov. It was sort of a kind of soft reboot. They sort of went back and brought Tony's origin more up to date, you know, so that it was in Afghanistan rather than, I think, was it the Korean War originally, James? I can't remember. Anyway,
I think it's Vietnam. And if I am being you on comic book knowledge, I need a gold star.
It can't have been Vietnam, can it? It was too early, though, wasn't it? Oh, no, maybe. I don't know. Anyway. But yeah, so it brought things a bit more up to date, and it kind of did shift the emphasis a little bit in terms of Tony's character as being more of a kind of experimental inventor rather than just, you know, a weapons hawker.
Was that pretty close to when Iron Man was released, that the comic was?
It was about 3 years before, I think. I think it's from 2004, 2005. Yeah, so it's a six-part story. It's the first six issues of volume 4 of Iron Man. 2005 to 2006 it ran. I think some of the issues were delayed, that's why it took so long. But it's a reasonably good self-contained Iron Man story that just kind of shifts and redefines the character. As I say, like, plot elements also found their way into Iron Man 3, but it's the starting point for the modern day Iron Man, basically.
I'm going to say, I definitely heard this comic discussed fairly regularly when Iron Man 3 was in production, so...
I think the artist on it was Adi Granov, wasn't it? And
yeah.
I'm pretty sure he, as a result of his work on Extremis, became the designer for the film.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, because they did redesign the costume for the time of Extremis, and it's very similar to the one in the film.
Right. James, what are you recommending to me?
I will recommend it's an Iron Man story called The Five Nightmares, which is written by Matt Fraction, drawn by Salvador La Roca, and it was published at the time of the film as a new Iron Man series, with the intention being, if you had seen the film, you would come into a comic shop and someone would say, here is the new Iron Man series. It's a relative of Obadiah Stane called Ezekiel Stane.
That sounds vaguely pornographic.
he's a sort of kid who is a genius, like he's maybe a late teens, early 20s,
right?
And he's kind of like Tony Stark without the conscience, is sort of the pitch for that character.
Okay.
And basically Tony's talking about his kind of five nightmares, which are, you know, things like, what if someone developed Iron Man technology who wasn't me and didn't have my morality?
Right.
I mean, it's kind of good in that it loosely sequelizes the film, in that it plays off the Stark and Stane relationship, but it's also good in that it kind of cuts the heart of why Tony Stark is the way that he is Iron Man and why other characters might not be.
Can I bring up something that we said on our email chains, you two have said to each other, that you found it particularly hard to recommend good Iron Man stories to me? Is that fair?
Okay, well, in the 80s, there was a very critically acclaimed run by Bob Layton and David McElhenney, who... they did this sort of famous story where Tony Stark becomes an alcoholic and loses his company and loses control of Iron Man and sort of rebuilds his life after hitting rock bottom. The problem is, those stories are told in a very... it's not even a 1980s style. Like, it's very... they're very 70s, so they're sort of... melodramatic and very heavily chaptered into individual issues, so sort of the action's all truncated, and it just, at the time, they were well regarded, but they've dated badly because the style has dated badly.
Yeah.
And since then, there hasn't been anything that's reached that level of acclaim. So you have sort of 10, 15 years of mediocre Iron Man comics in the modern style, and then sort of, aside from Extremists, nothing until the movie. And then everything that came after was influenced by the movie.
Yeah.
So it's really tough to say, pick up these Iron Man comics if you like the movie, because they're only the ones that were published after the movie that are sort of worth saying that to.
One of the things that struck me watching the movie was, I just couldn't imagine how something that looked, and I kept going to myself when I was watching it, man, that looks really cool. Oh, that is cool. that's just a really cool moment. And the suit looks amazing. And I was like, how does this look on the page? How does the Iron Man suit look on the page? Because I just can't imagine it looking that cool, or like the actual you know, metal of the suit.
That's why one of the good things about Extremists is that it's got Adi Granov. Adi Granov is very good at drawing metallic things, and he's probably the right. first artist to do Iron Man and make it look shiny and metallic with kind of modern colouring methods. Actually, one very, very last point on the film that I love that we didn't touch on is, I absolutely love taking the original massive, clunky, rubbish Iron Man costume,
yes.
putting it in the film and having it be absolutely awesome, as having it be the costume yeah. that he breaks out
like
the cave
a walking
in.
Tank.
And I'm just going to mention the two other things that I haven't been able to mention that I really liked about the film. Firstly, that everyone assumes that Tony Stark has post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's why he's not in public. And for him then to actually get PTSD in a future movie, it's like, that stuff in Afghanistan? No, that was fine. Battle of New York? Fuck me, that was bad. and then the other moment I liked was when Obadiah Stane says to Sony, do you really think that just because you have an idea, it belongs to you? It seems really pointed in superhero
does.
Movies right now, doesn't it?
Yes, and in yeah. and in comics in general for the last 70-odd years, yes.
Okay, well, I think that brings our Iron Man discussion to a close. I will read those Iron Man comics and talk about them on next week's minisode, and Seven James will be putting up the links to buying those on Comixology on our Panel Beats post. But now let's move on to our final section, which is the pitch, where Seven James both have 30 seconds to pitch me a comic book movie concept based on the parameters that I give them. This week, my question is, I would like to know how you would continue with Iron Man in the Marvel Cinematic Universe after Robert Downey Jr. gives up the suit. So you're going to have 30 seconds to make that argument, and Seb, I think we'll start with you.
I'm not sure how I can stretch this out to 30 seconds, but my simple answer is that I wouldn't continue Iron Man in the MCU without Robert Downey Jr. I think the other characters could feature in films, but there's absolutely no point in doing Iron Man without Robert Downey Jr. playing Tony Stark. It would lose most of what makes him such a good film character in the first place.
Excellent.
I know I'm going to lose.
Seconds, that's fine. Well, we'll see in about 30 seconds time if you're right. James, pitch me, how are you continuing the MCU without Robert Downey Jr.?
Okay, there's a Marvel comic called The Mask in the Iron Man in which Tony Stark's armor gets struck by lightning during the Millennium Bug and gains sentience. My plan is that this would happen to Tony Stark, but his consciousness would be transferred to the suit, put a filter effect over his voice. The Iron Man suit is now played by Robert Downey Jr. in voiceover, You don't have to get him in the films, but you can come in once every, you know, 6 months to do 2 hours of voice recording.
Wow. That's horrible, James. You can't do that. I mean, I don't think it's his voice that makes the Iron Man films.
That's the only way you can do Iron Man without without Robert Downey Jr. being in the films.
This is why I didn't want to countenance the idea of killing Tony Stark. So I tried to imagine films set where Tony Stark was dead and maybe all the other characters were carrying on his legacy. And I was like, but no, because my other option would have been to bring back Robert Downey Jr. as a voice, as the new Jarvis. So I had basically the same idea as James.
I think that's where the MCU is going. I would be stunned if Vision doesn't eventually have Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr.'s voice talking to him. If it was me, I would say either you don't recast Tony Stark, but you have a different character being Iron Man, i.e. Don Cheadle. I'd watch a Don Cheadle-led Iron Man movie when it becomes clear that Robert Downey Jr. isn't coming back. Or I would have Vision taking over the Iron Man franchise, and it would be they would be called Vision movies, but essentially he would be the Iron Man stand-in.
You must be the only person on the planet pitching a Vision movie.
You've never read a comic with the Vision in, have you?
Well, I know nothing about the character, but I like Paul Bettany, and I like the idea that Paul Bettany running around with Tony Stark's voice in his head doing superhero-y things.
I think the easier solution is you keep on driving dump trucks full of money up to Robert Downey Jr.'s house and you never let him leave.
Yeah, but he's going to be so old. I think almost by default, I almost have to award the win to Seb this week. But I hate both of your ideas. Why aren't your ideas the same as mine? Okay, so that's just about it for this week. You can find us on Twitter at @CU_podcast, or if you want to find us individually, I'm at @JoeCunningham14, Seb is at @SebPatrick, and James is at @JamesHunt. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, on Stitcher, or you can access the RSS feed directly by going to cinematicuniverse.libsyn.com. I'll be back next week with another minisode, and all three of us will be back in 2 weeks' time for our fourth full episode. And if you want to find out what we'll be talking about then, stick around until after the music at the end. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Crikey, O'Reilly! Cinematic Universe will return in 2 weeks' time with Agent Carter.